Greetings, this is podcast number 21 of Blast the Right. I'm Jack Clark from therationalradical.com, www.therationalradical.com. Today there are two segments. First segment is More GOP Racism. The second segment is Same Intelligence? Bush Lies About His Lies. As usual, I'll give music credits at the end. Let's get right into the first segment. More GOP racism. What does the more refer to? I discussed GOP racism in podcast number 11, the segment entitled Sean Hannity's Big Lie About Civil Rights. There we saw how the Republican Party went from being the party of Lincoln to being the anti-civil rights party. Also, before I get into the details, let me explain what I mean by racism. I'll define racism in the context of two other terms, prejudice and discrimination. To me, prejudice is a person's attitude, the way they feel, what they think about some group. They don't like a particular group. They think a particular group is inferior. That's prejudice. A feeling and attitude. Discrimination is when an individual acts on their prejudice. Maybe they refuse to hire for their business members of a certain minority group, or to rent their house to members of a certain minority group. Discrimination is acting on prejudice in a way that hurts the affected group or person. Racism, the way I use the term, is when the state or a powerful institution acts in a discriminatory way and thereby hurts the affected group or person. Examples of racism, such type of state action, would be the Jim Crow laws, apartheid, slavery, the Nazis. Racism can take the form of the use of state power to hurt, a sin of commission, Jim Crow laws, for example, slavery. Racism can also take the form of a sin of omission, the failure to use state power to protect when there's an affirmative duty to do so. For example, when state and local officials fail to protect African Americans against lynchings in the South. Some of the most virulent types of racism are very subtly practiced, almost by subterfuge. They harm minorities without seeming to have, at least on the surface, any racial component. A good example of this is the GOP's so-called Southern Strategy, starting in the late 1960s. That strategy was designed to get the vote of whites who were upset that the Democrats had lent their support to civil rights and voting rights for African Americans. This is how the GOP's Southern Strategy was described in a 1981 interview by Lee Atwater. The late Lee Atwater was the grandpappy of all Republican strategist gurus. Karl Rove was a disciple of Lee Atwater. Before I read what Atwater said, let me mention that instead of the racial epithet that rhymes with trigger that Atwater uses, I'm going to use the term N-word. This is what Lee Atwater said, quote, "You start out in 1954 by saying N-word, N-word, N-word. By 1968, you can't say N-word. That hurts you, backfires. So you say stuff like forced busing, states' rights, and all that stuff. You're getting so abstract now that you're talking about cutting taxes, and all these things you're talking about are totally economic things. And a byproduct of them is that blacks get hurt worse than whites." Close quote. Now the question may arise, can you be racist? Can a government act in a racist way without being prejudiced? I don't know what's in a right-winger's heart. I don't know what they really think. I can only judge them by their actions. So when I describe right-wing racism, GOP racism, I'm not saying what's in their heart. I'm not accusing them of having prejudice in their heart. I'm just speaking about the results of their actions. I'm just arguing that the results of their actions are racist. Their actions and policies use state power to harm minorities or fail to protect the minorities when the protection is called for under law. I'll now get into the examples. This information is taken from a couple of New York Times articles and a New York Times editorial. One of the stories was by Pulitzer Prize-winning Supreme Court reporter Linda Greenhouse. I have three examples, and I'm going to go from the general to the specific. First example of GOP racism on a federal level. The Civil Rights Division in the Justice Department has been, as the New York Times put it, quote, systematically gutted, close quote, by Bush's two attorney generals, Ashcroft and Gonzalez. Career lawyers have been driven out. And the division's focus has been changed from civil rights enforcement to deportations, immigration matters, and human smuggling. In all its time in office, the Washington Post reported that the administration has filed only 3 lawsuits regarding discrimination in voting. And one of them accused a majority black district in Mississippi of discriminating against white voters. Yep, just like Christmas is being attacked, and it's an issue that the right wing has to jump on, white voters being discriminated against is certainly where the civil rights enforcement effort in this country should be directed. So on the federal level, we have racism as a sin of omission. The Bush administration is not carrying out its legally mandated duties to protect minorities, causing them harm. Let's go to the second example of GOP racism. The state of Georgia, that bastion of racial tolerance and understanding, recently passed a law that required voters to have a picture ID to vote. The officials claimed it was to protect against fraud. This was a solution to a problem that didn't exist. There were no widespread reports of people fraudulently voting, claiming to be someone else. Georgia citizens who didn't have a picture ID could buy one for $20. There were offices set up to purchase them in only 59 of the state's 159 counties. Who are the citizens in Georgia who wouldn't have a picture ID? Overwhelmingly, it would be poor minorities. As the New York Times put it, this was, quote, little more than a modern-day version of a poll tax aimed at reducing turnout among poor minorities, close quote. The Justice Department is charged with overseeing changes that Georgia makes to its election laws. Alberto Gonzalez's Justice Department okayed this law. The Justice Department lied and said that the law was approved by career lawyers at the Justice Department. That was wrong. A federal court has struck down this law. Isn't that interesting? Alberto Gonzalez, a Hispanic himself, a member of a minority group, approves a law designed to reduce turnout among poor minorities. If you'll recall, Gonzalez promised to make civil rights enforcement a priority of his, a priority, when he became attorney general. Like with all right-wingers, the truth is the exact opposite of what he said. The third example of GOP racism involves the state of Texas, another bastion of civil rights enforcement and racial understanding. Texas is one of those states with a history of racial discrimination in voting. So under the 1965 Voting Rights Act, the Justice Department has to approve any redistricting in Texas. Now, the redistricting is the responsibility of the local Texas officials, their legislature. Usually, redistricting is done once a decade after a census. But Tom DeLay, pulling the puppet strings from Washington, had the Texas legislature redistrict in 2003. By the way, Tom DeLay's current legal troubles involve how money was raised to support this redistricting. In any event, the 2004 congressional elections came along, and under the new map, Texas delegation went from 16 Republicans and 16 Democrats to 21 Republicans and 11 Democrats. Republicans gained 5 seats. Now, how is this an example of a third example of GOP racism? Well, earlier this month, the Washington Post reported that there is a bombshell memo that the Justice Department has been suppressing for nearly 2 years. In that memo, 6 lawyers and 2 analysts in the voting rights section of the Justice Department, and that includes the group's chief lawyer, concluded unanimously that, as summarized by the New York Times, quote, "The Texas redistricting plan of 2003 illegally diluted the votes of blacks and Hispanics in order to ensure a Republican majority in the state's congressional delegation." Closed quote. In the words of the memo itself, quote, "The proposed plan reduces the level of minority voting strength. The state failed to follow its traditional redistricting principles, preserving communities of interest and forbidding fragmentation or packing of minority voters." Close quote. But apparently, according to the Post, political appointees overruled the lawyers, and the lawyers were ordered not to discuss the case. And then the Justice Department approved the Texas plan. So again, we have a right-wing Bush Justice Department harming minorities, failing to protect them, acting in a racist way, the use of state power to harm or fail to protect when required to by law minority groups. Now, Democrats challenged this plan, and the federal court upheld it. I don't know anything about the judges on that court that did uphold it. Just last week, however, the Supreme Court announced that it was going to decide the validity of that Texas congressional map. It took the case. The legal situation is complicated. There's apparently appeals being brought by 4 groups of plaintiffs: Democrats, Hispanic and black voters, as well as the city of Austin. We'll have to see what happens with this. Given the increasingly right-wing tilt of the Supreme Court, I don't have my hopes up. In case you're wondering, unlike their timidity on many issues, the Democrats have been speaking out forcefully about this. The chairman of the Texas Democratic Party said, quote, "Tom DeLay and his corrupt cronies were willing to sacrifice the voting rights of millions of Texans to carry out a corrupt, partisan, mid-decade restructuring scheme." Close quote. Nancy Pelosi, who's the House Democratic leader, said that the Supreme Court's taking of the case was a, quote, "hopeful sign," close quote, that it will, quote, "restore the Voting Rights Act to its historic role in furthering justice for all Americans," close quote. And Steny Hoyer, Maryland representative and the Democratic whip in the House, said that the disclosure, quote, "that political considerations at the Justice Department apparently overrode proper enforcement of the Voting Rights Act should appall and disturb every American, close quote. He's right. But it doesn't appall and disturb right-wingers. No, they support these actions. So there you have it. Evisceration of the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division? A Georgia poll tax intended to make it harder for poor minorities to vote in that state? And a congressional redistricting plan to reduce minority voting power in Texas? Racism, the use of state power to hurt minorities, or the failure to use state power to protect minorities? The GOP is guilty of both. The next time you're talking to your friendly local right-winger, ask him or her why their party's actions are so racist.
To kind of catapult the propaganda. In my line of work, you got to keep repeating things over and over and over again to kind of catapult the propaganda. Catapult the propaganda.
Let's now talk about Bush lying about his lies. If you lie about a lie, does that equal the truth? In mathematics, if you multiply a negative number by a negative number, you get a positive number. But I guess that doesn't apply to lying. If you lie about a lie, that's probably just an even worse lie. The lie I'm talking about is Bush's same intelligence lie. This is what he said.
When Democrats say that I deliberately misled the Congress and the people, that's irresponsible. They looked at the same intelligence I did, and they voted, many of them voted to support the decision I made.
The Washington Post reported that Bush has repeated this same intelligence claim 102 times. And if Bush has said it 102 times, Hannity must have said it 1,002 times. He repeats it every 5 minutes. Bush first lied about what the intelligence on Iraq said, and now he's lying about whether that intelligence was the same intelligence the Democrats saw. He's lying about his lie. Bush is wrong as a matter of the way intelligence is routinely handled in Washington, and he's wrong on the specifics of the Iraqi intelligence, what the Democrats saw and what the administration knew that the Democrats didn't. Regarding the way intelligence is routinely handled in Washington, Senator Dianne Feinstein of California, who's a member of the Senate Intelligence Committee, recently asked the Congressional Research Service, a nonpartisan service used in Congress by Republicans and Democrats, to address the issue of what intelligence information is available to Congress and what is available to the White House. The report was released last week. It concluded, quote, "The president and a small number of presidentially designated cabinet-level officials, including the vice president, have access to a far greater overall volume of intelligence and to more sensitive intelligence information, including information regarding intelligence sources and methods," close quote. The report also listed 9 U.S. intelligence products, important ones, that Congress is generally not given. Among them is the President's Daily Brief. The President's Daily Brief will be a key element of some of the specific examples I'm going to give later. Senator Feinstein is worth quoting about the report. She said, quote, "The report demonstrates that Congress routinely is denied access to intelligence sources, intelligence collection, and analysis. This report goes to show that members of Congress were not seeing the same picture as the administration. When the Senate voted to authorize the use of force in Iraq in 2002, it was based on a more limited scope of pre-war intelligence than was available to the administration," close quote. This Congressional Research Service report doesn't give examples of Iraqi intelligence that Bush and the administration knew about, but that Congress didn't. I'll give you three specific examples. I'm taking these from a Frank Rich column in the New York Times, a story reported by Murray Wass in the nonpartisan National Journal, and a report released last month by Senator Carl Levin. Here's the first example of intelligence that the Bush administration knew, but that they hid from Congress. If you recall, Bush and his various underlings were issuing dire warnings about mobile biological weapons labs that Iraq had and that could deploy against us and its neighboring countries. The only problem is U.S. intelligence authorities had been told by Germany's Federal Intelligence Service that those reports were probably wrong. The source for them was not credible. There was an Iraqi defector that Germany had in custody named Curveball, and the German intelligence officials thought he was lying or that he didn't know what he was talking about. The administration knew this. Did Congress? No. Nor, for that matter, did the UN when Colin Powell included this claim in his presentation. Bush also included this claim in his 2003 State of the Union address. If you'll recall, that State of the Union address also included Bush's infamous 16 words about Saddam's African uranium, a claim also later debunked. Okay, so the Bush administration knew that its claim about biological mobile weapons labs was based on faulty intelligence. Congress didn't know that because the Bush administration didn't share that part of the intelligence with them. What's a second example of the administration having intelligence that Congress didn't? This would be the Murray Wass story in the nonpartisan National Journal. He reported that 10 days after 9/11, quote, President Bush was told in a highly classified briefing that the U.S. intelligence community had no evidence linking the Iraqi regime of Saddam Hussein to the attacks, and that there was scant credible evidence that Iraq had any significant collaborative ties with al-Qaeda, close quote. In fact, Wass reported, Bush was told the exact opposite, that what few credible reports of contacts there were probably attempts by Saddam Hussein to monitor al-Qaeda. He viewed them, since they were theocratic radical Islamicists, as a threat to his secular regime. At one point, he even considered infiltrating it with Iraqi agents to find out what they were up to. All this information was delivered in a President's Daily Brief, one of those documents that the Congressional Research Service report showed is not shared with Congress. Did the congressional Democrats who voted for the war and now criticize it, were they aware of this information? No, the administration withheld it from them. Let's go on to the third example of intelligence the administration had and that Congress didn't. This is from a report released last month by Senator Carl Levin. Administration officials were making repeated assertions that al-Qaeda was being provided by Iraq with chemical and biological weapons training. In one instance, Bush said, "No, we've learned that Iraq has trained al-Qaeda members in bomb making and poisons and deadly gases." Later he said, "No, Iraq has provided al-Qaeda with chemical and biological weapons training." The only problem is, at the same time that they were making these blanket, unqualified assertions, the Defense Intelligence Agency had told the administration regarding the source of this chemical and biological weapons training charge in a document that Congress didn't know about, that it was, quote, more likely this individual is intentionally misleading the debriefers, closed quote. And the CIA had told the administration, again, and Congress didn't know this, that the CIA believed The informer was not in a position to know this information. So here you have three examples of Congress not having the same intelligence as Bush did and being misled thereby. Let's go back to what Senator Feinstein said. Quote, members of Congress were not seeing the same picture as the administration when the Senate voted to authorize the use of force in Iraq in 2002. It was based on a more limited scope of pre-war intelligence than was available to the administration, close quote. And the article adds that, quote, Feinstein asserted that the report's findings underscored how critical it is for the Republican-controlled Intelligence Committee to complete a long-delayed inquiry into the intelligence used by the White House to make its case for the 2003 invasion of Iraq, close quote. Fat chance. They don't want that inquiry to come to light. I ask you, if members of Congress knew that there were no links between Saddam and Al-Qaeda, if members of Congress knew that Saddam did not have mobile biological weapons labs, if members of Congress knew that Iraq was not training Al-Qaeda in chemical and biological warfare, if members of Congress knew that Iraq did not have a nuclear weapons program, maybe they wouldn't have allowed Bush to invade Iraq. But since Bush and the neocons were hell-bent on invading Iraq no matter what, they lied about the evidence and withheld information and intelligence from Congress and the American public in order to bamboozle Congress and the American public into supporting the war. What more impeachable offense could there be? So the next time you hear this same intelligence nonsense from a right-winger, ask them whether they're just completely misinformed or deliberately lying. Throw some of these incontrovertible facts in their face. Well, that'll about wrap it up for today. If you enjoyed what you heard, please tell your friends about Blast the Right. If they don't know about podcasting, turn them on to that as well. If you think podcasting is something that they just won't get into, then simply send them the web address of my podcast homepage and tell them to put their email address in the FeedBlitz sign-up box. That way they'll get email notifications of each new podcast. Music credits. The opening instrumental was L.A. Nightmare by 22 Caliber. You can find them at music.podshow.com. The bumper music between segments was Catapult the Propaganda by Nise Music, NISEmusic.com. I'm going to close the podcast with a little clip I put together. It combines the end of Howard Beale's famous speech from the classic film Network with a bit of a great cut called No Justice, No Peace from the group Wackiavelli. They're at wackiavelli.com. WackiAvelli.com. Wackiavelli is going to be on Chuck D's Air America radio show January 8th. And thanks to a Long Island listener for finding the Howard Beale clip for me. All the information about music I play on Blast the Right can be found on my music resources page, which is linked to off my main podcast homepage. Also, links to all the data sources I use in the podcast can be found on my data resources page, also linked to off the main podcast homepage. Now, this is the last podcast before some holidays, so let me wish each and every one of you, as appropriate, Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, Happy Kwanzaa, and Happy Holidays to cover any celebration I've left out. In the spirit of the season, I'm going to modify my usual closing and not call right-wingers pieces of crap. What I'll say instead is, until next time, I'll sign off and say I love you all, including all you right-wing, wayward sheep. Please come back into the fold of humanity. And now an exhortation applicable to us all from Howard Beale and Wackiavelli.
You've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value. So I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
What matters, hell?